Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history, and I'm your host, Karen Peter. Now, here at Cup of Joe, we partner with the Historic Sites Foundation to interview the presenters from their lecture series. And right now, we're interviewing folks from their spring 2022 lecture series. And our guest today is Michael Wright. Michael lives in Rome and has for the past 20 years. He is director of the European programs for Duquesne University. Michael has restoration roots that began as early as the Kirtland era of the church. And relatives such as Kirtland Temple architect Truman O. Angel and Brigham Young. He was born and raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and his faith journey led him to be baptized in Community of Christ in Italy in 2019. As an Italian citizen, he's currently the only member of Community of Christ in Italy, where he serves as the National Ministry Coordinator. He also serves on the leadership team of Community of Christ fully online congregation, Community Circle in Western Europe, and is a student, like you're not busy enough. He's a student in the Master of Religion program in Community of Christ Seminary, part of Graceland University. So with all of that in the back of our mind, hi, Michael.
Hello, Karen. It's great to be with you.
It's so good to have you back here at Cup of Joe. And I'm really excited about this because your contribution to the Historic Sites Foundation Spring Lecture Series this time around. And John Evandet was the first Italian missionary of the reorganization. And you gave a little description of your lecture, which I was happy to see, that he was born among the Waldensian valleys of the Piedmont region in 1828. At a time of great change in Italy, born as a Waldensian, a primitivist, a dissenting faith tradition, Evandet's faith journey introduces him to the Restoration and takes him on a literal journey from the Italian Dolomites to the Wasatch Mountains of the American West, to the prairies of Nebraska, and back again to his native Italy as the reorganization's first Italian missionary. So in your lecture, you're going to explore the places, the denominations, the historic events, and the folks who he encountered and get to know him a little bit better. And he certainly is a little known saint. I had not heard of John Evandet. So how'd you first learn about him?
Well, before I joined Community of Christ in 2019, I went through a thorough period of seeking or investigating in LDS terms with this newfound denomination. I ordered copies of the Book of Mormon and Community of Christ's Doctrine and Covenants in a very meaty three-volume set of church history by Mark Shearer called The Journey of a People. As I was reading his work, I came across John's name in Volume 2, The Era of the Reorganization, 1844 to 1946, where there is one mention of him about his missionary calling in 1872 to serve in Switzerland, France, and Italy. Now, his anglicized first name and his French last name did not make me think he was initially Italian, but I was really curious about him and I started to search for more information, especially since he served a mission in Italy, my home. But I kept finding that Evandet would show up in works by other historians too, such as Michael Homer. But again, just a quick line mentioning that the RLDS Church had tried their hand at missionary work in Italy without much success. Now, my two cheerleaders during these past 2 years of research and searching for Evandet have been Barbara Walden, Executive Director of Community of Christ Historic Sites Foundation, and Rachel Killebrew, the librarian and archivist at the Temple in Independence. I have to thank them for their encouragement and to Rachel for finding a picture of John Evandet in the Community of Christ archives for me. This really brought him to life for me. I also traveled to his home village, Prarostino, last week. I've been trying to get there forever, but COVID has not made that possible. No. So I finally was able to get there along with other places you will hear about in the interview today. Although Prarostino is now a modern Italian village, it still has an ancientness about it. looking probably very similar to the way it did when John was a boy. A mountain village with terraced landscaping for grapes for wine production and the Waldensian Church of San Bartolomeo in the center of town. The local cemetery holds the name of generations of Avendettes and other last names like Gardiol that you will hear about later. This too brought John and his family to life for me.
All of that from a one line mention in the third volume, you make me want to go back and mine those volumes again for other nuggets of information that can lead us on wonderful explorations. And it sounds like you did just that. So why don't you tell us a bit about him? We don't want to feel everything that you're going to share from your lecture, because we hope our folks will go and listen to your lecture and participate in the question and answer. But let's hear a little bit about John Avendette.
I've kind of brought some things together that will give you an idea about him in case you can't come, but I hope you will come, because I'm not going to be giving the whole story, and I've got a lot of great nuggets that will be during the lecture. But I also have a little candy bag grab today that I'll share with you that I won't share in the lecture. So just to kind of reward people that come to both places.
Ooh, just for our Cup of Joe listeners. Excellent.
Yes, yeah. He has a fascinating story, like so many who travailed the challenges of immigration in the 19th century. As I mentioned before, his name does not sound very Italian, because it isn't. The geographic area that he comes from in the Piedmont region of Italy, where Turin is the capital today, is and was a multicultural mix of identities. Separated by the Cotian Alps, the French and Swiss borders are very close. Today, you can easily drive between Turin and Geneva in Switzerland, or Grenoble in France, in about 3 hours. This is a part of modern Italy that has a difficult story, as the valleys just west of Turin in the foothills of the Alps, called the Waldensian Valleys, were the location of the Waldensian people, and the first location where Restoration missionaries came looking for convents. These valleys spoke 4 languages, including the daily use of dialects that come from Provençal and the Occitan languages, including the Waldensian dialect, along with French, since it was the cultural connection to these valleys, and Italian as the language of the court and all things legal. This is the reason why his name is Jean Avendette, a French name, but he is absolutely Italian. So most listeners are probably asking themselves, what does Waldensian mean? When folks think of Italy, they automatically think of Roman Catholicism. The Holy Father, Pope Francis, who lives in the smallest state in the world, the Vatican City, which is just about 30 minutes driving from my house here in Rome. And they think of thousands of years of church history in the Eternal City, including St. Peter's Basilica, where Peter is supposedly buried. When we think of Protestantism, we normally do not think of Italy. Yet, Torre Pellice, a little village not far from Jean Avendette's home village, is today the headquarters of the Waldensian faith. This Italian Protestant denomination today would look much more like Community of Christ than the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Yet in the 19th century, there was quite a bit of intersection between Mormonism and the Waldensian faith. And today they are in fellowship and connected with the Methodist Church in Italy. In fact, the head of the Tavola Valdese today, which leads their annual synod, which would be like our World Conference or an LDS General Conference, is a Methodist woman minister. So yes, the Waldensians have ordained women since the 1960s. And in 2010, they began to bless same-sex couples, as marriage is not a sacrament in their tradition. But this is a persecuted people, and John lives right at the end of the persecution. The Waldensian movement was started by a disillusioned Catholic merchant in Lyon, France, named Peter Valdo. His last name is what gives the group its name. He lived in the 12th century. He heard of a monk who practiced extreme poverty and was moved by it, and decided to devote himself to a life of poverty and preaching. He critiqued the rich and the corruption within the Catholic Church. His group of followers, which included other mendicant preachers, including women, were excommunicated. Women preachers were accused of witchcraft and executed in horrific medieval style. It was not a great time to be a woman in the Middle Ages. After being almost annihilated by the church, they moved across the Alps into what is known today as the Valdensian Valleys of Italy. Here, they would be confined by the Duke of Savoy to their ghetto, which are the valleys. I just remind listeners that ghetto, that we use also in English, is an Italian word, and unfortunately was used as a place to individualize Jews. It's an anti-Semitic term in Italy, and it will apply to the Valdensian people. They would lose their civil rights and be forced to work the rugged land of the mountains to ensure they were poor and unlearned, even if they could see from their mountain heights the fertile valleys below that ran towards Turin. Their churches had to be built above 800 meters, so 2,400 feet above sea level, by law, making sure that these people of faith would stay high in the mountains and not tread on the valleys below. Coming into the valleys below meant certain death for those who tried. But in February of 1848, the Duke of Savoy returned civil rights to the Valdensian people and to the Jews, allowing them to come out of their ghettos. Centuries of persecution and poverty meant that they started to look beyond their mountain homes for a better life. February 16th is still celebrated annually as a day of liberation for the Valdensian people, where they light bonfires in their mountain villages that can be seen from the valleys below. It is in this environment that Apostle Lorenzo Snow, an early missionary of the Restoration, who would be chosen by Brigham Young. He followed Brigham Young during the schism. And would be called by him. He'll also become the president of the LDS Church in 1898. And his missionary companion, Joseph Taranto, as he's known today, but he would be Giuseppe Taranto as his Italian name. He was the first Italian member of the Restoration, a Sardinian who was raised in Sicily, who joined the Restoration movement in Boston, and he too would follow Brigham Young on off to Salt Lake. He was called with Lorenzo Snow on a mission to these people in 1850. In my lecture, I'll speak about why Young felt that the Mormon church was a natural fit for the Valdensian people. So you have to come to the lecture to find out.
Excellent.
Yes, Avendet was from the little Valdensian village of Prarostino. I already said that name. It's a hard one to pronounce, which streams up the mountainside for about 5 miles above the Chisone River and the Pinerolo Valley. He joins the Mormon church in 1863 and immigrates to the U.S. that same year with his wife and three-year-old son, Jean-Louis. He and his wife, Marie, are 35 at this time. They accepted the offer by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to fund their move to Salt Lake through the Perpetual Immigration Fund. They went with a few other folks from their village. The thing that gets me is the commitment to travel to their desired Zion of Utah. The trip took 5 months from their village to arrive in Salt Lake Valley. I will tell you how they got there. This is crazy to me. I'm upset when I'm in economy between Rome and New York City on a 10-hour flight, right? Here's what they did. The trip would begin by moving down the mountain to the valleys close to Turin, where they would take the train to Mount Cenis. From here, they would board coaches on skis led by horses over the very high Alps into France. There, they would take the train to Lyon and another to Paris. At Paris, they would board a train to Calais, where they would change to a ferry across the English Channel. Again, on train to London, where they would switch again and take a train to the northern English city of Liverpool. Because of their poverty, they would board almost immediately the immigrant ship, the Ark in the Antarctic, which would set sail on May 23rd for New York City, with nearly 500 saints on board, divided into branches by nationality. So it was over a month just to get to Liverpool. The Avendets were assigned to the French branch. After nearly 2 months at sea, they would arrive in the United States, where they would board immediately trains that would take them on a long journey across the country from New York City to Albany to Niagara to Detroit, on to Chicago, down to St. Joseph, Missouri, where they switch to a riverboat that will take them to Florence, Nebraska, which is Omaha today. Now there, they joined one of multiple church-organized wagon trains that would depart across the plains until they arrived in Salt Lake City in September of 1863. They would have been welcomed by other church members at Public Square in the 8th Ward of Salt Lake, which today is called Washington Square in Salt Lake City. For reasons I have not yet found, Avondette would not follow other immigrants from Italy to Ogden, Utah, where most of the prior families from his valleys had established their homes. Rather, he would stay in the 8th Ward in Salt Lake to establish a shop and buy a home. I remind everyone that they did this with a 3-year-old boy.
Yes.
As the American Civil War was raging, journals from those who traveled along with him spoke of measles outbreaks on the ship and deaths along the way of loved ones and children, of marriages between single new Mormons heading to Zion together. They spoke of singing and worshiping along the way and even encounters with Smith relatives on their train stops across America as they traversed the United States. It sounds like the story could stop here, Karen. I'm already exhausted recounting the geographical journey they took to get to their new home. But this is really just the beginning for the Avondette family, the beginning of what must have been an excruciating and complicated decision to make. After just 2 years of being in Salt Lake, something happened, and the Avondettes decide to leave Utah. During the lecture, I'll speak more about their time in Salt Lake City, but we do know why they left. In a Herald article, we get to hear the voice of Marie Avondette de Fourry, which is John's wife, and she explains a vision she had. This is really special because as I searched both for more information about John's wife and son, and it is in Marie's letter that we get confirmation about their faith journey and what would take them elsewhere. So I want to share a little bit about that from that Herald article. That Herald article is in volume 16 from 1869, a letter she writes to Joseph Smith III. I'll share just a little bit about it. Brother Joseph, the faith without practice is broken, lost, and become ineffectual to sustain us. This just came to pass with me when I discovered the work of polygamy. Before, I was very happy, thinking I was a member of the true church. From that time, I was troubled in my position regard to the Brighamism. Sometime after that, I found the reorganization, but the doubt came out again. But after one long struggle, the Lord, in his tender mercy, reserved for me a great and unspeakable joy. There is nothing in this natural world to express my feelings. It must be understood in consciousness of the mercy of God. One evening in July 1868, after my supplication and prayer, and calling with faith, believing and hoping for an answer according to my desire, having known many times already whom it is not in vain we search, nor needlessly we found, I went to bed and fell asleep calmly and profoundly, when about midnight I was awakened by a strong blow on my breast, which I cannot explain otherwise than if it were like a stroke of thunder. That commotion did not do me any harm. The noise left off softly. I opened my eyes and I saw one immense block of cloud, very white, and in the middle, like the body of a man clothed in a white mantle and bright. This beautiful sight did not move until I had plenty of time to note this vision. Great was my amazement and admiration. I exclaimed, "The kingdom of God." And immediately one voice like thunder answered, "We, yes." This voice came from behind the cloud. I knew it was the voice of my husband, and I said, "Thou wast not deceived." The same voice answered, "No." I said again, "Then it is the church of God." The same voice of thunder answered, "We, yes." This picture only I saw. The eyes of that heavenly being were fixed steadily upon me. I looked always with admiration, and then after a few moments, it disappeared gently. Behold, this is my testimony, and I thank my God with all my heart. Madame Marie Avondette de Fourry, there's a note that says, this is translated into English from the French, and the Herald welcomes other languages as submissions, which I thought was really beautiful. So I think that's maybe why the English is a little bit choppy there too. But we hear her voice and her vision that she was seeking, and she was very nervous to leave the LDS faith.
I find that doubly interesting, Michael, because we so seldom get to hear women's voices when we look at church history. And so to hear her concerns, her supplication, and what she experienced as a response to that is marvelous.
Absolutely. I was so excited to find that. We certainly know that they would have come into contact with Josephites, or those from the reorganization who were preaching and warning new European immigrants headed for Utah what laid in store for them. Both Thomas Henry White and Samuel H.B. Smith, who were traveling west with the Avondots, write of these experiences in their journals. And we know that the first reorganized missionaries were called to preach in Utah the same year the Avondettes arrived in 1863. From the Saints Herald, too, we know that reorganized missionaries were preaching mainly in Salt Lake City town. So I asked myself, did John have any contact with the reorganization on the way to or during those years in Salt Lake City? A question I don't know, but is plausible. Well, their house and shop were put up for sale in mid-1865, and they moved to Omaha at the end of that year or the beginning of 1866. Again, this must have been a fearful moment for the Avondettes, as there were rumors at the time that Brigham Young and his Danites might force them to turn over their home, shop, and maybe even their child to repay their debt of immigration. However, the Avondettes made it safely to Nebraska and set up a home and a clothes repair shop. The history of the church in Omaha, Nebraska, in the Journal of History, speaks of Avondette's baptism in 1868 by Elder Joseph Gilbert, and speaks of him as one, quote, one who lived for many years in Omaha and was known among all the saints for his kindness in times of sickness and his effective administrations. Now, administrations in RLDS speak is laying on of hands. In September 1871, at the semi-annual General Conference in Council Bluffs, Iowa, John Avondette's name was suggested to the Quorum of 12 for a foreign mission. And at General Conference in April 1872, he is officially called to serve in Switzerland, France, and his native Italy. His missionary companions would be Swiss natives, John Baer, and a brother, Ursenbach. During the 2 years that he labored back in Europe, he spent most of the time in his home village of Prarostino, among the Valdensian valleys. His mission was difficult, and he reflected in multiple letters to the Saints Herald and with reports to the General Conference about this. A co-written article in the Swiss Times by Avondette and John Baer also mentioned the difficulty of convincing LDS members and ex-Brighamites to join the reorganization. You could say, Karen, that the RLDS missionaries in the 19th century were the first Latter-day Seeker ministers, as their main approach was to seek out those who had left the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Even though many wanted to believe the words that Avondette was preaching, they were afraid it was a trick, and that they were Mormons trying to convince people to come to Utah, where they would be forced into polygamy. You can hear Avondette's frustrations in his writings, which I will share during the lecture. To help with the economics of supporting his mission, he lived with his mother at Prarostino on the family farm. His father had passed away by this time when he served his mission, and he tended to the grapes for wine production on the farm. He worked all day, and they would find time to preach in the evenings and on Sundays. In a letter to the General Conference after his release in 1875, he names the two baptisms that he had in Prarostino, Italy, from the Gardiol family, Judith Marie and Jean Clarice in August of 1874. So Karen, these ladies would have been the first Community of Christ members to join the church in their native Italy. Two ladies, two women. When I found this information about their baptism into Community of Christ, I quickly took the opportunity to update their genealogical records online to show their religious affiliation with us.
Good job, Michael. It's fabulous. I love that it was two women were the first Community of Christ RLDS folks in Italy and from his hometown, it sounds like. So both Valdensian. Yep. That's marvelous. So he had quite an experience of travel. I mean, that whole immigration 5-month trip just mortifies me. Even when I just learned about the people who traveled from Independence, Missouri to Oregon, I can't believe it. So that's amazing dedication for a matter of faith, an amazing journey for a matter of faith, both geographical and emotional, with family in tow. What were the most important aspects of not just this journey, but his experience that you absolutely felt like you had to include no matter what in your lecture? Were there certain things that stood out as some of the most important aspects of his life?
Yes, definitely. I'm really amazed by his entire story. Mostly about how you drag your family across the world while Italy and the U.S. are both in civil wars, to go off to the deserts of Mexico to join a community building Zion literally from the ground up. I don't know what that brochure looks like, but I'm not sure that I would have signed up.
I'm not doing it.
I know. Yet two quick stories were surprising to me. Avondet's business was that of being a dyer, a clothes dyer. This would have been very normal where he was from. I already told you that he worked on a wine production, which of course grapes would have been used to dye as well. And then also these valleys were really known for silk production with silkworms. And this is a trade in Italy throughout the Middle Ages. People came to Italy to look for silk and also for precious dyeing of silk. You often hear about places like Siena or Tuscan places where they were using saffron and all these things to make beautiful, beautiful clothes. Italy still makes beautiful, beautiful clothes today. But this is what he did. He was a clothes dyer, and he had a clothes repair shop. So he was arrested and taken to court in Salt Lake City in 1864 for distilling and selling illegal spirits. So remember, his family is in the wine business in Italy,
right?
So he knows how to ferment, right? And this must be his side hustle, right?
Yes.
To take care of his family. He was fined by the court and reprimanded, and I would say humiliated in the Deseret News. And in Omaha, he suffered multiple break-ins to his home and his shop. I think these things make him sound like a human being instead of this pioneer missionary. So one of these exciting incidents sparked a real ruckus in Omaha. I probably won't have time to share this during the lecture, so I wanted to share it here with our readers. I want to read a little bit from this. This is from the Omaha Daily Bee I don't have the date here. I'm very sorry, but this would have been in the 1870s for sure. The article says, "Big crowd chases thieves. Sprightly race of 10 blocks terminating in a fight between officers and prisoners. Two men dropped in at John Avondet's dye shop, 1350 California Street, Thursday afternoon. And when the proprietor wasn't looking, each helped himself to a coat and vest and walked out." Now, they're in Omaha living at this time. The little incident got in motion a train of circumstances, which included a 10-block foot race, a fight in which five men participated, two black eyes, a broken head, two arrests, and more excitement in and about Hoagland's lumber yard than the vicinity had seen for months. It all came about through old man Avondet seeing the thieves as they left his place. He took after them, baying like a foxhound on a hot scent. Block after block they ran, the thieves just out of arm's reach, down 13th Street to Dodge, and then to eastward onto Dodge. The crowd behind him taking on every leap. At 9th and Dodge, Officer Mike McCarty joined in the race. A block further down, Chief Donahue and Captain Hayes fell into the ruck, and from this point on, the race became a scramble. It was no longer possible to recognize individuals. To the main current of the chase, the chasing throng, every cross street added its quota of humanity. People of all ages and conditions converged upon it from every direction. The ruck traveled fast, but news of it traveled faster. And by the time the fugitives concluded to take cover, Hoagland's lumber yard and advance guard bore down upon them from the front, and they stood at bay. There were some injuries, some fighting, these things, and it just ends up with, for some time, it was thought that Brennan, who was the person that confessed to the theft, would not survive the blow to the head, but he spat blood for some time and then lapsed into unconsciousness. But he was better at last accounts. The thieves were booked, and Dan Williams and John Brennan and the stolen property was recovered for old man Avendet. So it's just a great little piece to find. You can tell that they're on the frontier. Things are violent. People are doing what they can. It doesn't seem that Avendet was, he was howling like a hound down the street. So it gave
and he was old at this point, they said. Old man Avendet. Yeah. I can picture this like one of those old time movies where you see somebody running and then pretty soon everybody's joining in the fray.
Exactly.
Marvelous. So yeah, that does make him a little bit more human, that and his arrest in Salt Lake and just some of the other aspects of frontier life. We forget this is frontier life when we're talking about what's going on here, especially when we talk about it in the context of the church. So you live in Italy, obviously, and so this had some special connections for you, but I assume there also were some challenges to finding enough information about Avendet. So what were some of the challenges, besides COVID, what were some of the challenges you had?
COVID was really complicated for me because I had trips set up to go to Salt Lake City and to meet with some people and meet with the LDS Church History Department and the museum to go and take some pictures of some of these places that I was learning that maybe he was at. I had some real questions and that never happened. I still haven't been to Salt Lake. And then I wanted to go to the Valdensian Valleys, and I just was able to do it last week. So it was really quite complicated, but I'm so glad I got to go. But the story of John Avendet and his family, it's difficult. I have had to rely on 19th century newspaper resources in both Utah and Nebraska, the accounts from the Saints Herald, and the Journal of History from about 1868 to 1950. He dies in 1910, but his son won't die until 1915. So really kind of a long time of scouring through these documents, along with piecing together parts of the story with journals of people who were journeying with them and history books and scholarly journals on people who had similar stories to Avendet's at the same time period. I wish there was more information available from his youth, but I know only a bit about his family's business and when he was christened in the Valdensian church. From the time he joins the Mormon church, there is much more information about him. Probably if he had remained a faithful member of that church, we would have even more information about him.
Right.
And then he starts to be a prominent member of the RLDS church in Nebraska, along with serving a mission in Italy. But with this now 2-year long project hobby for myself, I have at least found articles and letters written by all three members of his little family and the Community of Christ archive, which only had a photo of John, which you'll see in the lecture, along with a handwritten letter by Joseph Smith III, writing that Avendet is an official representative of the church and a minister of Christ, asking for safe passage and respect to him while he serves his mission in Europe. These are fun artifacts, but I hope with diligence I will continue to find more about him. I gave a small talk on him last year as part of Community Circle's The Disciples Toolbox series, and even from that talk, I have found corrected information on his story, which I'm excited to share. Another difficult aspect of understanding John's story is that which I spoke of at the beginning of the interview about where he comes from. In my research, I have found his name spelled in many ways, sometimes using his wife's last name, sometimes with an Italianization of his last name, Avendetto, sometimes misspelled last names in wrong geographic locations. In fact, his ship passage showed his family being from Ireland, not Italy, even though at Ellis Island, they were able to correct that information. Because he was French speaking, he is often said to be from France or from Switzerland, or called a French saint, even though he was indeed an Italian saint. He just happened to be a French speaking Italian saint.
Which helped when he got assigned to the French berth on the ship over, I would assume.
Exactly.
Being the only Italian. So one of the things I'm always interested in is the kind of the hope as we listen to church history that we each make a difference in the greater faith community, that each of us, as we participate, somehow makes a difference. So do you see any reflections of John Avendet, or maybe the DNA of his ministry floating around in Community of Christ today?
Yes, absolutely, Karen. Avendet took up the literal long road to correcting what he and his family saw as injustice in polygamy. He was willing to sell all he had, take up the trail with his wife and now 5-year-old son to go east, a foreigner in a far off land and now an outcast apostate in two traditions, not just one, Valdensians and the Mormons. He went fervently seeking for where the Spirit was moving him and his family. I have met so many Latter-day Seekers and members of Community of Christ who have done the same in their own contexts. They have been fearless, but that doesn't mean they didn't feel fear and have gone where the Spirit has taken them. Community of Christ's history is one of seeking an identity and wrestling with theology in order to better understand our desired Zion. Avendet's family did just that. Through discernment and revelation and complete sacrifice as a family, they strive to bring peace and justice to their communities, whether that was in Omaha or in their beloved Italy.
Thank you, Michael, for that. I think that facing injustice might be a long thread of DNA that we can give thanks to the Valdensians for as well, experience. So what effect has your study about John Avendet, how has that informed your own journey, your own journey of discipleship? It's been 2 years since you've engaged with him. How has it affected you?
A lot. I never really kind of thought I would have this affinity for him, you know, but there was something really pulling me to him. In the lecture, I'll talk much more about his life in Omaha, Nebraska, and his time amongst the Reorganites, as he would call them, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and what his family was going through. But, you know, we already talked about the geographic challenge of going west, but we rarely talk about the path east. As a kid growing up in Nebraska and Oklahoma, I knew of the Reorganized Church and had heard the awkward stories of Emma Smith in my childhood tradition. I say awkward because it seemed no one knew how to speak about Emma in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. My own lovely mother in hushed tones would tell me that she thought the Lord would be very merciful with Emma for leaving the true church because she had been through so much trauma, including the loss of children and her beloved husband, Joseph Smith Jr. I went to Independence with my high school seminary class. Seminary in the LDS tradition is a high school course that we take in scripture. And just as the Independence Temple was being completed in the mid-90s, my well-intentioned and loving seminary teacher took us to the LDS historic sites where we could gaze safely onto the sites of the other Restoration churches. Also, interestingly enough, during my stake youth conference trip to Nauvoo while I was in high school, I got to tour the RLDS Visitor Center, where two European sister missionaries spoke to us and gave us a tour of the sites. I think we have now figured out that that might have been Eva Eriksson from Germany and Kirsten Jeska, who lives in Norway. They serve on the Western European Mission Center Council with me, and I have been able to get to know them better through the ministry in Europe. And yet they knew my 16-year-old self on that one tour.
That's
amazing
marvelous.
How things come full circle. And like I said before, I spent many of my teenage years living in just south of Omaha, Nebraska, and my LDS ward or congregation was in Nebraska City, which I learned in Community of Christ Seminary almost became the gathering spot for the reorganization. But alas, Lamoni, Iowa offered a better deal to Joseph Smith III. Florence, Nebraska, which is now part of Omaha, is where Winter Quarters was located, the frontier spot where the saints following Brigham Young to the Great Salt Lake Valley were preparing for the long crossing with handcarts and wagon trains. I myself have relatives buried at Winter Quarters. But for us folks who come from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint tradition, the hardness of that faith journey towards Salt Lake is only told with Western-bound itineraries. It is as if the Mormon Trail was a one-way highway, taking folks from the United States to Mexico, where Deseret or the Utah Territory was located. But the idea of only Western-bound folks makes no sense. Even my own great-great-great-grandfather, Truman O. Angel, who was an architect on the Kirtland Temple and go on to build the Salt Lake Temple and Tabernacle, along with the St. George, Manti, and Logan temples in the LDS tradition, would be sent on a mission in 1856 to Europe to study the great cathedrals of the United Kingdom and France to bring it to temple building. This meant that he had to travel east on that trail. The postal service, pioneers, visitors and tourists to the West returning home. And yes, in the words of my own great, great, great uncle Brigham Young, even nasty apostates were traveling in opposite direction on the trail between Utah and Nebraska. Yet we hear so little about the eastbound folks and their journeys of faith. All of this is critical to understanding the life of Avondette and his family. But I also have this great affinity for John because I see multiple intersections in our lives, in my life with his. As I said before, I grew up just south of Omaha, where Avondette spent the second half of his life building the RLDS church. He helped preach, give administrations or laying on of hands, and attending conferences in Nebraska City, the place where my LDS congregation of my youth was. He joined the LDS church and became disillusioned with the tradition because of the injustice of polygamy. This could no longer be the place where he envisioned his Zion and that of his family and community. So he headed east and continued search for his community and to help build the Zion he dreamed of. I was born in the LDS tradition, but was marginalized by the theology of that tradition. I too could no longer stay and needed to seek my own Zion. And I did that by heading east to Italy, Avondette's native land. We both became immigrants as adults. We both joined Community of Christ, Avondette on March 26, 1868, and I joined on March 25th, 2019. Our baptism anniversaries are just one day apart. We both are Italian and US citizens. I became an Italian not through heritage, but by full participation in Italian society. And he did the same in the US. We are both Italian second language speakers. His native tongue was most likely Occitan or French. He would have spoken Italian as a secondary language. And I also learned to speak Italian after my move here 20 years ago. He served a hard mission for 2 years in Italy for Community of Christ. And I served a 2-year mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Spain, which was a hard mission too. We both served people we loved and were often frustrated with peoples of the Mediterranean lands. He served as an elder in Community of Christ, and I am preparing to serve as an elder in Community of Christ too. I look at his beautiful ministry he provided and hope that I might bring that to the church and to people as well.
Well, Michael, I would say you do already. This has been a wonderful conversation about John Avondette, and I want to thank you for sharing his life with us. Before we close our conversation, do you have any last thoughts about this experience you'd like to share?
It's kind of hard to think that there's more that will be shared in the lecture after this long conversation. But I always have more thoughts. So I wanted to just leave with these thoughts. As you mentioned in the introduction, I'm currently the only member of Community of Christ in Italy. Yet we have several seekers right now interested in the church and one preparing for baptism this summer. The church has never had much of a presence from the 19th century to the present in Italy. There are stories of members of the armed forces, mission center presidents, and those who came in the diplomatic corps were on business to Italy over the years. But Italians joining the church has never been part of our robust story. However, Italians have and are part of the story of Community of Christ. I see Community of Christ's vision of Zion or the peaceable kingdom and restoration in the healing sense very applicable to the society I live in and the people I live amongst. As I served a mission in Spain, I know how frustrated Avondette must have been at the lack of response to his message in Southern Europe, especially after hearing and seeing so much success in the United Kingdom and Northern Europe. After all, the Italian mission was part of the English mission at the time. Plus, Avondette would have been wanting his own family and friends in his close and tight-knit village of Prato Stino to join him in the reorganization. Yet Prophet President Grant McMurray's comforting plea to the church in Doctrine and Covenants 163, which was given to the church in 2004, speaks to Italy, past and present. Quote, "Do not be unduly concerned with numbers. Be fervent in your witness, passionate in your discipleship, and vigorous in your labor on behalf of peace and justice. Where two or three such disciples from community form community, there will be the Spirit, and many will come to see." Close quote. These are comforting words to me, and I think they would have been to John Avondet as well.
Thank you, Michael, for joining us today for this conversation about John Avondet. And for our listeners, we want to really encourage you to view Michael's lecture, John Avondet, the First Italian Missionary of the Reorganization. And it will air on May 5th at 12 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. Rome time, I'm assuming, that part of Europe.
Yes, yes.
Or if you cannot watch it at that time, you can view it later. It will be in the Historic Sites Foundation archives, mm-hmm. and you can find that at historicsitesfoundation.org. And be sure to check out the other lectures from the spring series at historicsitesfoundation.org. This is Cup of Joe, part of the Project Zion podcast. I'm Karen Peter. We've been chatting with Michael Wright from Rome. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.